welcome to our Conscious Relationship Seminar Series. I'm David Steele. I am founder of Relationship Coaching Institute and author of Conscious Dating, Finding the Love of Your Life in Today's World. This is a monthly series in which we interview top experts in the relationship field for my network. If you'd like to join my network, if you're not private already, please go to consciousrelationshipresources.com. And we have newsletters and programs and resources, e-programs, audio programs for singles, for couples, and for helping professionals as well. These programs are recorded. The recordings of our past programs are podcasted, and we have a podcast website at consciousrelationshippodcast.com. So you want to catch our past program, that's where to go. Tonight's program is No More Mr. Nice Guy, Getting What You Want in Love, Sex, and Life with Dr. Robert Glover. Dr. Glover is the author of No More Mr. Nice Guy, and he is in private practice in Bellevue, Washington. He conducts workshops all over the world on No More Mr. Nice Guy, a proven plan for getting what you want in love, sex, and life. And I heard about you, Dr. Glover, from a friend of mine that took a workshop here locally. And he called me up after that workshop and said, you got to get this guy on your program. So here we are. Welcome, Dr. Glover.
Here we are. It's good to be here, David.
So if you are too concerned about what other people think of you, if you spend too much time taking care of other people, if you're having a hard time making your intimate relationships work, if you're frustrated with your sex life, then have we got a program for you. Because today you will learn how to stop seeking approval and make your needs a priority, how to build healthy, vibrant relationships, how to tell the truth with love, how to set the tone and take the lead without being controlling, 3 rules for great sex. Okay, I'm looking forward to that one.
So am I. That sounds great.
So, Dr. Glover, what is the nice guy syndrome?
David, the nice guy syndrome is a fundamental belief that a person, a man or a woman, has that says, I'm not okay just as I am. Nice guys, nice girls believe they have to become what they believe other people want them to be in order for them to be loved, in order for them to get their needs met, and in order for them to have what they believe to be a smooth, problem-free life. So nice guys are typically constantly seeking approval and avoiding conflict or disapproval.
You know, that resonates for me. I'm a nice guy. I think I have the nice guy syndrome.
Well, as people were introducing themselves, you know, many men and women in the audience were identifying themselves as nice guys or nice girls. And as one of the fellas said, you asked him if he was a nice guy, and he said, well, I try to be. And I could relate to that because I spent most of my life trying to be a nice guy. And I thought that was the ideal life roadmap for living my life. And I thought everybody should try to be a nice guy just like me, and then the world would be a better place.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I found out through trial and error over time that paradigm I was using actually didn't make me a nice guy and didn't ever get me what I thought it was going to get me.
So what's wrong with being a nice guy? What happens when you're a nice guy?
Well, here's the most fundamental problem with being a nice guy, because the core belief system of every nice guy is that if I'm just good enough, if I just do everything right, if I never upset anybody, if I have everybody's approval, 3 things will happen. Now, the nice guys, nice girls aren't walking around consciously thinking this all the time, but it is the core paradigm or roadmap of every nice guy.
Right.
One thing they believe will happen if they're just good enough is that everybody will like them and love them.
Yeah.
They're very uncomfortable if anybody doesn't like them. And so they have this distorted belief system. Everybody should like them, and if they just do everything right, that will happen. That's core belief number one. Core belief number two, that if they look out for everybody else's needs and anticipate everybody else's needs, and if they give, then everybody else will do the exact same thing for them. People will anticipate their needs and give to them without the nice guy ever having to ask or express what they want. That's core belief number two. Core belief number three is that nice guys believe if they do everything right, never mess up, or if they at least keep their mess-ups hidden from view, when don't let anybody ever see that they made a mistake, then they will have a smooth, problem-free life in which nothing ever goes wrong, nobody's ever upset at them, and everything just works out perfectly. That sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Well, so far you got me nailed. Okay, what else?
But unfortunately, that paradigm doesn't work. By being a good person isn't going to make everybody like you, because not everybody's going to like you. That's just as a childhood fantasy of wanting everybody to like you. Number two, giving to other people so they will give back to you without you ever having to express your needs is fundamentally manipulative, and it's part of what I call a covert contract. It's that I'll give this to you, and in return, you'll give this back to me. Now, the problem with covert contracts, and nice guys use them all the time, is that, number one, the nice guy's usually not aware that he has a covert contract. He's not thinking, I'm giving to get, but yet he is. And number two, the other people or person or people involved or the rest of the world has no idea that there's this unconscious covert agreement. They have no idea they now owe the nice guy something because of the fact that he's been a nice guy and perhaps given something to them. So there's one fundamental problem. The third fundamental problem is that we don't live in a smooth, problem-free world. We live in a chaotic world. Things go wrong. Bad things happen. And nice guys believe that if they just do everything right, it's a grandiose belief system, they can make this chaotic world somehow be smooth and problem-free. So that leads to a lot of frustration because everything they try to do eventually doesn't take them down the road they want to go.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And, of course, it's an adaptation. It's a survival mechanism. It's what we think we have to do to be okay and survive and get along and be loved.
Sure.
And it doesn't work very, very clearly.
Most of us have been doing that since we were children. And whatever roadmap we developed in childhood, we think should work in adulthood. And when it doesn't, we typically just keep trying harder, hoping we'll get different results.
Right.
And as you and I both know, that's the definition of insanity.
Right. So, and changing that, though, is very scary and very uncomfortable because we think we're going to be rejected, we're going to be criticized. We're definitely going to get into how to fix the nice guy syndrome. So where do you want to start with that, about removing barriers or, you know, what to do?
Here's the thing that we need to understand about nice guy syndrome. It fundamentally is an anxiety-based disorder. It grew out of our childhood anxiety of growing up in an environment that perhaps was less than ideal. Perhaps people who were supposed to love us left us for one reason or another, either intentionally or unintentionally. Perhaps our childhood was unpredictable. Oftentimes I've found with nice guys is that, especially in the men I work with, many have tried to be different from their fathers, who were either distant, absent, abusive, alcoholic, angry, philandering. And many of the men I've worked with also had to take care of the needs of either an emotionally dependent mother or a cold or critical mother. And so growing up in these kind of environments created a lot of anxiety for the young child. And so the child tries to find any solution it can to try to make sure his world works out so he doesn't have to feel anxious, and to also to try to manage their anxiety so they don't feel anxious all the time. And then, as I said, unfortunately, we get into adulthood, and we're still using the same techniques we learned as children when we were young, immature, had no resources. We had no ability to reason very well. But we whatever we developed then, we're still doing as adults to try to manage our anxiety. So one of the fundamental things we have to be aware of is that when we talk about breaking free from the nice guy syndrome, we're not talking about becoming a jerk, becoming a bad man or a bad woman. That's not what we're talking about. What we're looking at primarily is helping men and women stop trying to manage their anxiety and learn how to soothe their anxiety, because we're always going to feel anxious in life. And trying to be a nice guy actually ratchets up your anxiety. Because if you think about it, if you're trying to get somebody's approval all the time, how anxious is that going to make you?
Well, it's going to make you pretty anxious because you can't maintain somebody's approval all the time, 100% of the time. If the fear of disapproval is what's making you anxious, that will never go away. That will always be there.
Exactly. And that's why trying to manage anxiety by getting people's approval or never making a mistake or avoiding conflict, those attempts to manage anxiety never do make the anxiety go away and actually tend to ratchet up our anxiety. Because ask, you know, later on, if we ask all the men and women listening, For example, how do they feel if somebody's angry at them? Or how do they feel if somebody gives them a disapproving look? And everyone will say, well, it makes me anxious. And then they go into overdrive to try to do things to solve whatever that problem might be, not to really make the situation better, but to try to change things so they don't feel anxious anymore.
So if managing anxiety doesn't work, and you recommend soothing anxiety, how do we soothe anxiety? What do you mean by that?
Well, that's an interesting concept, and it's interesting because when I began talking, just a couple of years ago about this concept of soothing anxiety, I noticed I lead 5 therapy groups a week in my office here in Bellevue. I do seminars and workshops. I do online classes. And almost every single time, whether it's in a group, a class, or online, people would say, tell us about soothing anxiety. So this is one of those questions that every recovering nice guy and nice girl wants to know about. Now, there's no magic formula here, because one of the things I've found is that for a lot of recovering nice guys, they believe that, okay, they understand, after they read my book or come to a seminar or take a class with me, they grasp pretty quickly, okay, this paradigm that I have of trying to be good and trying to look out for everybody else so that everybody will like me, I'll get my needs met without having to ask, I'll have a smooth, problem-free life, they go, okay, I get it. I see why that isn't working. They can give me illustrations from their life why it isn't working. But one of the things I've discovered is that as these men and women keep doing their recovery, there's still this core little thing back in their head that says, okay, once I break free from the nice guy syndrome and I become a better person, then people will like me, I'll get my needs met, and I'll have a smooth, problem-free world. So we're never going to have all those things. So part of soothing our anxiety is actually coming to that understanding. Not everybody's going to like us. It's up to us to ask and take responsibility for getting our needs met. Nobody else on this planet is put there to make sure we get our needs met. And we're not going to have a smooth, problem-free life. So maybe that cognitive awareness is the first thing we have to come to grips with in order to start calming this anxiety.
Mm. Yeah, great point. We need to adjust our expectations, our goal of what we're trying to accomplish. If what we're trying to accomplish is impossible, then our life won't work.
No, and we will just stay anxious because if we believe it is possible to get everybody to like us, or if we believe it is possible to have a smooth, problem-free life where nothing goes wrong and nobody ever gets mad at us and nobody ever leaves us, if we think it's possible, we'll keep trying to make that happen and living in a state of constant anxiety because it isn't possible. The next thing that I tend to share with the people I work with is number one, learn to calm yourself from within. And probably the most effective thing you can do is to begin to just breathe. When you're stressed, when you're anxious, oftentimes we don't even realize that our body is clenched up, that our chest has tightened, that our breathing has become shallow and slow. How many people listening to me right now have a problem with their shoulder blades being almost glued to their ears because they're so tense and their shoulders hunch up? That's what happens when we feel anxious. Take a breath. Calm yourself. Just breathe. Slow your breath down. The brain chemistry and the hormones in our body, the cortisol and things like that are related to stress, your body shifts as you calm your breathing. So as simple as that sounds, just taking a breath when you find yourself in those anxious situations of somebody being upset at you, you're running late, you're afraid you're in trouble, you're going into a new situation, you're doing an interview on the radio, whatever the case may be. Take a few breaths and just calm yourself.
Yeah, I've heard that it's impossible to take 3 slow, deep breaths and not be relaxed.
It does actually change body chemistry. So that's the one reason why it calms you. Now, another thing, and this is also sounds so simple, but yet it's so powerful, is that what your brain is telling you, what your mind is telling you when you're anxious is, oh no, this is going to be terrible. Oh no, I can't handle this. Now, the mind believes what the mind tells itself is true. Mm-hmm. And so whatever our mind is repeating, even at an unconscious level, the mind believes. And so we can actually change what the mind is telling itself. And one of the most effective, powerful things that I've learned to do is, as I said, to calm myself, take a breath, and then tell myself, I'll handle it. It's going to be okay. Whatever happens, I can handle it. That goes contrary to that voice just chattering back in the background that says, oh no, this is terrible. Oh no, you can't handle this. One of my all-time favorite books, I highly recommend it to your listeners, is a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Dr. Susan Jeffers. Wonderful book, easy read, and that's the core premise she talks about. Whenever you're pushing yourself in life, challenging yourself, growing, you're going to feel fear and anxiety. Calm yourself by just repeating, I can handle it. No matter what happens, I'll handle it.
Okay, so let's say that we can soothe our anxiety. We understand the need to let go of being a nice guy, and we want to make our needs a priority and stop seeking approval. How do we handle the guilt? It's like, you know, well, I don't want to be selfish. You know, I don't want to put myself first.
I jokingly tell the people I work with, I say, when I look up the word selfish in the dictionary, I want to see your picture. Now, you're right. We have this negative connotation in our culture about selfishness. But here's an interesting thing about the word selfish. About the only time I ever really hear the word selfish is when somebody is trying to manipulate somebody else to get them to do what they want them to do. So, for example, if somebody tells you, well, you're just being selfish by not calling your mother, da-da-da-da-da, or you're just being selfish because you're going to go do what you want to do, what the person is really saying is, I'm selfish because I'm not getting what I want, and it's your fault, so I'm going to tell you that you're being selfish, so you'll quit doing it, and I'll get what I want. Kind of an interesting phenomenon about that word.
So you really have to critically examine, why is this person calling you selfish?
Exactly. Now, here's an interesting phenomenon, and actually I experienced this about a week ago in one of my men's groups with one of the guys in the group. His wife had been wanting him to do something significant that he wasn't comfortable doing. He left group one evening feeling very confident of where he stood on an issue, came back in the next week, and he totally caved on that. And then the group members asked him, why? Why'd you give in? You seemed really clear and confident what it meant to have integrity about this for yourself. And he said, well, she brought up that it just wasn't fair because she had done da-da-da-da-da, and therefore I owed her da-da-da-da-da. And he goes, you know what? I felt guilty because I didn't have any argument for the fairness thing, and so I gave in. And what I realized in that moment, that actually he used guilt as a way of managing his anxiety. And he felt anxious that his wife was unhappy with where he stood. She was using every argument she could to sway him to change his mind. And when he began to feel guilty, all of a sudden, that allowed him to cave and therefore manage the anxiety he was feeling of his wife being upset at him. And that was quite a revelation for me to realize most of the time, guilt is nothing more than an attempt to manage anxiety, especially if it's what we'd call neurotic guilt, where you haven't done anything wrong. Right? Just that maybe somebody's upset at you or thinks you should do something different. So guilt is one of the things we're going to feel if we're actually standing up for ourselves and making our own needs a priority or having integrity or setting a boundary. We might feel some guilt. And we're going to have to do the exact same thing that we did every other time we've had to deal with our anxiety, and that is calm ourselves. Tell ourselves, no, I believe this is the right thing to do. I believe I'm acting with integrity. I'm going to hold on to my boundary. I'm going to do it with love. And I'm going to calm myself and breathe my way through this. I'm not going to let my, quote, guilt, unquote, cause me to cave in order to make my anxiety go away.
Yeah. You know, it becomes really hard to identify what your boundary is, what it is you really want, when you're a nice guy and is so focused on wanting to please and wanting everything to be okay. And then when you do know what it is you want, it becomes very scary to tell the truth about it. And so, you know, managing the anxiety and, you know, handling the guilt is, you know, very helpful. How about a recommendation or two for those folks that I know, including myself, that sometimes just have a really, really hard time identifying what it is we really want in this situation because we're so used to playing the nice guy role?
And that's a great question, because oftentimes when I'm working with nice guys and we're talking about making their needs a priority, man, if you want to see a deer in the headlight look, you know, just tell the nice guy, let's start helping you put your needs first to make your needs a priority. And, man, I remember when I started dealing with those issues several years ago, it's like, oh, no, if I make my needs a priority, I'll be totally unloved, unliked, and all alone. I mean, everybody will leave me, they'll get mad at me, and they'll leave. Now, I'm going to tell you a personal story. This happened several years ago, back when I was married. I was married when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy. I've actually been single now for 5 years, so I get to see the application of these principles both within a relationship and for single people as well. So it's kind of a unique perspective. But this occurred back when I was married, and I was just coming to grips with a lot of my nice guy patterns. And I was actually one afternoon working on writing a chapter for the book. And a friend of mine called me up, and he and I had made plans to do something the following weekend. And he called me to kind of nail down the plans, and I started to hedge on him. I started to kind of hem and haw and said, well, you know, my wife Elizabeth at that time, she's not really sure what she wants to do this weekend, and you know, I better wait and find out what she wants to do first, and then I'll get back to you. But it may not be Saturday; it might be Sunday. And my friend got mad at me. He had a justifiable anger, and he said, "Robert, that makes me angry because you and I had plans, and now you're waffling because you're trying to make Elizabeth happy, and Elizabeth doesn't even know what she wants." And he said, "You know, I expect you to keep your word to me." And I said, man, you're right. I'm sitting here writing a chapter for my No More Mr. Nice Guy book, and ironically, the chapter was on making your needs a priority. And then I said, thanks, Mark. I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to have some integrity about this. So I actually went home, and I told Elizabeth about the conversation I just had with my friend. And I said to her, you know what? I haven't been acting with integrity. I've been waiting for you to decide what you want to do so I can make plans. And I told her, for this entire weekend, I am going to focus on making my needs a priority. I'm going to go do this Friday night. You're welcome to come with me if you want. I'm going to do this with my friend Saturday, and then Saturday night, I have this time available if you want to join me. And then Sunday, I'm going to go do this. You can come with me for that. Whether you do or not, that's what I'm going to do. And then I did all of those things, and I told her what I was going to do. And she joined me for a few things. We negotiated a couple things, but I did all the things that I told her I was going to do that weekend.
What was her reaction when you laid that out like that?
When I laid it out, she absolutely had no reaction at all. I call that telling the truth with love, just speaking the truth with love. I didn't do it out of anger. I just said, here's what I'm going to do. And I also invited her to join me on several of those things, but whether she did or not, I was still going to do them.
Okay, and she was fine with that.
Her response was, okay, thanks for telling me what you're going to do. And then she joined me for a couple of things over the weekend, a few of the things I did with some friends. And came the end of the weekend, she told me, she said, you know what, this is one of the best weekends I've ever had with you.
Oh, wow.
And boy, that blew me away. And it really proved the point to me that as long as I was seeking her approval and putting my wants and needs down in the gutter and just waiting for her to set the tone, she wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. And when out of love, I just said, here's what I'm going to do this weekend. Come join me on these occasions if you want. If not, that's fine. She just thoroughly enjoyed being in my presence that weekend. And I tell that story because as you're listening to it, as everybody else is listening to it, they're going, oh, yeah, but that wouldn't work for me. You know, we think, again, like I did, that everybody would not like me, they wouldn't love me, they'd get angry at me, they'd argue with me, they'd tell me I was being selfish, and they would probably abandon me, and none of that happened.
So it's probably true that the anticipation of the explosion is far worse than the reality. So it's the anticipation of the guilt or the rejection or the anger. And, you know, even if it is real, well, it's not the end of the world, but chances are that's not exactly what's going to happen.
And typically that's what I learned during the time I was married and working on my nice guy issues, is that every time I kind of withheld or didn't tell the whole truth or tried to steer something in a certain direction because I didn't want my partner to get angry or explode, it typically led to conflict and stress. And one of the things I learned very powerfully throughout the relationship, that whenever I just spoke the truth, just said what I really felt, asked for what I really wanted, and did it without love or blame, I found that my partner typically responded like a mature adult, and we just usually had mature, calm discussions. Another example of this is, I remember, I was raised by an emotionally needy mother, and she has a kind of a talking disorder. She talks all the time, and I always thought my job was to listen to her talk, and that I couldn't go do what I wanted to do until she was done talking and whatever her emotional state was resolved. And so I also repeated that same pattern in my relationships. And one time a therapist told me that I didn't have to keep listening until a woman was done talking. And I said, "You're kidding me. I thought that was etched in stone. I assumed that was required." And she said, "No." And I remember the first time that Elizabeth was telling me some story about her day that I was just totally uninterested in. It wasn't that I didn't care about her. I just was not interested in that particular story. And it was kind of going on. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to tell her the truth. And I said, "You know, I'm just not interested in this story." And boy, I thought the roof was going to come off. And she said, "Oh, okay. Well, thanks for telling me." And she went and called a girlfriend. And she told me later on, she thanked me for telling her that instead of pretending to listen to something that I wasn't interested in. So like I said, a lot of these things that I did anticipating a certain reaction was more in my mind than in reality.
Yeah. Let me ask you, as a nice guy, when I get up the gumption to tell my truth, and it's a bit scary, and it provokes a bit of anxiety, sometimes it comes out with a little more force because I'm anxious about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, how do you tell the truth with love? How do you soften it? What do you think about that?
Here's the thing. We're not going to try to soften it, because trying to soften it is typically what nice guys are doing that gets them in trouble. Here's a fundamental thing. Most nice guys believe if they tell the truth, there will always be negative consequences. And in fact, the reason people lie, all children lie, because they're not powerful. Everybody else in this world is bigger than them and has the power to hurt them. Children lie because they're not powerful, and they do it to try to level the playing field. It's based on magical thinking that says the other person has no way of knowing the truth, so whatever I tell them, they'll believe, and therefore I'll feel safe. Now, unfortunately, when we lie as adults, we actually keep ourselves in a state of anxiety, because every time we tell anything less than the truth, and that's my definition of a lie, anything less than the whole truth. For example, if you leave a little bit out, that's a lie. Or if you just don't tell somebody something because you're afraid of their reaction, that's a lie. Right? If it's information they should have and we withhold it to keep the peace, that's lying. I'm pretty strict on that one because I've had to confront this in myself. In fact, when I started confronting my tendency to tell whatever I thought I needed to tell to make sure I kept the peace, whenever I'd hear that little voice, and everybody who's listening knows what I'm talking about, you hear that little voice that says, "Oh, don't tell them that. They're going to be really upset. Oh, tell them this way, because then maybe that they won't get mad at me. Or leave this part out, but tell them that." Okay, that's that little voice that's telling you to lie because it's afraid of consequences of the truth.
Right.
What I did when I started confronting that in myself is every time I'd hear that voice, I would do the opposite and just go and directly tell the whole truth. In fact, I would often even tell on myself that I was considered telling a lie. And so I just got it all out on the table. The amazing thing is, following that new paradigm didn't cause anything in my life to melt down. It actually made everything better. Because if every time you tell a lie to somebody, you're operating on a belief system that says, "I can't handle the consequences of telling the truth," that keeps you feeling powerless. It keeps you feeling anxious. Every time you tell the truth, even when you're anxious, is sending a subliminal message to yourself, "I can handle this. I can handle the outcome of telling the truth." So I'm a big advocate of telling the whole truth, nothing but the truth, right? Now, here's the thing. As you said, sometimes that comes out pretty strong when we first start doing it. And the reason for that is, and I talk about recovering nice guys often become like kamikaze boundary setters. Or, you know, they use a chainsaw when a fly swatter would do. And the reason for that is we've been backing up from our boundaries for so long. We've been avoiding for so long. We've been letting stuff build up for so long. When we finally do get around to speaking our truth, man, it's got a lot of intensity behind it, and it often comes out as somewhat of a victim puke. It just, you know, comes spewing out of us. So one of the things I found, that if we can just speak the truth now, in the here and now. Now, that takes a while for nice guys, because I found that typically, as we're doing our recovery, our goal is to move that time gap from the moment that something happens to the moment that we actually respond to it, right, to make that gap smaller and smaller. I remember when I used to tell, you know, somebody, if I'd, you know, gotten mad at them 2 months after the fact, you know, I finally let my feelings out, and they'd say, well, why did it take you 2 months to tell me? And I'd say, hey, I'm doing better. You know, it used to take me a year for this to come out.
Yeah.
Well,
so
now it's gotten closer.
Build up.
Yeah, and that buildup is what creates that intensity that you're talking about.
Yeah. So the bigger the gap, the more the buildup. So yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so our goal is to get that gap as small as possible, and then what we have to say will typically come out in a more clear, direct, non-challenging way, non-blaming way, and people can hear that. If we're not accusing them of something, if we're just saying, oh, man, you know, it made me angry when you were late. We're not saying they're bad. We're just saying what I felt. And typically people can hear that and go, hey, man, you're right. I'm sorry. You know, I didn't give myself enough time. But
yeah,
if we start calling them names or say you're always late or that's so inconsiderate of you to stand me up, well, there's blaming. That's a victim puke. And people aren't going to usually respond very well to that. They're going to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, to counter the self-talk, you know, well, if I tell the whole truth, they're not going to like it. They're going to be unhappy. What do you think about the idea of prefacing what you say with your intention, like, I need to tell you my truth right now, or I just want to be honest with you about this, so that you're not only telling them, but you're reminding yourself that you're taking care of yourself this way.
And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with what you suggest, and maybe that's a good way to start practicing it. Because, like, for example, if I'm in a restaurant and the waiter or waitress has been doing a good job, but say the food has taken a really long time or something's frustrating, sometimes I will say to the waiter or waitress, I'll say, okay, I need to tell you about my frustration, but I don't want you to take this personally because I know it's not about you, but I just need to let you know I'm feeling really frustrated about how long it took to get my meal. You know, I told them ahead of time. All right. I'm going to express myself. Don't take it personally. It's not about you. And that can be helpful. Now, one of the things that I've found, and the reason that why I give kind of a partial endorsement to what you suggest is because what's happened is probably we're still looking for a way to try to calm, you know, try to manage our own anxiety.
Right, exactly.
And the truth is, you know, when it comes down to it, if we just say to somebody, you know what, I'm angry that you're late. Now, that's not blaming, it's not scolding, it's not shaming, and I think that's the clearest way to put it. Now, for example, when I talk with men about dating, one of the things I talk with men about is to set the tone and take the lead in a healthy way, and that's one of the things we said we'd talk about today. So, for example, when I go on a date, if I go out on a second date with a woman, I'll usually tell her a little bit about myself and how I go about dating. And I'll tell them, for example, that I don't chat on the phone because I think chatting on the phone speeds up relationships too fast and creates a bond before you really get to know a person. And I'll tell them I like to go slow. Phones are for setting up dates, not for chatting. I'll see you about once a week. We'll go do some stuff, and we're going to get to know each other. And it's interesting because the guys I work with that tend to have a lot of anxiety about dating anyway, they say, well, how do you tell the woman that? How do you tell her that you don't chat on the phone? Because they're all thinking, if you tell a woman you don't chat on the phone, she's going to go ballistic because that women tend to like to chat on the phone. And I'll go, good question. I said, usually I just say, I don't chat on the phone. and they're looking for this elegant way to tell the woman so that she'll respond without a negative response, right? They're trying to manage their anxiety by, how do you do that? How do you tell them that? Well, I just tell them. I don't chat on the phone. And you know what? I've never had a woman respond negatively to that statement of telling her what I do. But, again, nice guys think that there must be some way to tell the truth where people won't react. But yet, if you just tell the truth, whether they react or not, you'll handle it. But typically, they don't react if you just tell the truth.
Right. So it seems like the key is letting go of attachment to the person you're speaking your truth to having a certain reaction or being okay. You just got to be able to let go enough to have them not be okay with your truth.
Man, you hit the nail on the head with that one, David, because when I started dating and I had all the frustrations that a lot of guys do have about dating, of not wanting to be rejected and not wanting to look foolish and not wanting a woman to tell me no, and those are all attachment. You know, I never wanted a negative outcome from approaching a woman. And it dawned on me before too long that I had to let go of those kind of attachments to any kind of outcome if I was going to be successful. You know, the Buddha said attachment is the cause of all suffering, and I believe that's true. It's when we're trying to manage to get a certain outcome, i.e. nobody reacting to us, nobody being upset at us, nobody rejecting us, nobody telling us no. That attachment actually takes us out of integrity. Integrity inherently means you have no attachment to the outcome. Integrity means you ask yourself what feels like the right thing to do or say, and then you act upon what feels right to you. That's integrity. Worrying about outcomes will always take you out of integrity. Then you're going to start trying to manage things around you to try to manage the outcomes. And one of the things that I wanted to say earlier about the nice guy syndrome, about one of the core things about it that really is not good, is that this attachment to outcome of wanting approval, of trying to manage our anxiety, of trying to make sure nobody ever abandons us or gets mad at us, makes nice guys fundamentally and inherently dishonest. We never say what we really want. We never say what we really feel. We never act upon what we really believe is right if we're attached to outcomes. And so letting go of those attachment to outcomes, and maybe that's one of the most challenging things in our recovery from the nice guy syndrome, that is crucial to become this honest person, a person with integrity, a person that other people can get close to and want to be close to.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And is this the right time to talk about sex, do you think?
I don't think there's a bad time for talking about sex, right? We can talk about sex anytime.
Okay, well, three rules for great sex. What are they?
Three rules for great sex. And everybody get their pen and their paper out to write this down. And it is so simple. And actually, this fits really well with our discussion about non-attachment to outcome. Because one of the things I find with many of the men I work with, now, my background, my doctorate is in marriage and family counseling. So I've worked with couples for over 25 years. Since my book came out, my work's pretty much evolved where I work with men, not exclusively, but a lot. And I still see couples. I still listen to the men and women talk about their relationships, their intimacy, their sex life. And these three rules have come out of that work and come out of this letting go of attachment to outcome. So this is typically what I tell men. Now, really, the same thing could apply to a woman, too, in terms of great sex. But the three rules are tied to the reality that when you have attachment to outcome, whatever that may be, that you don't want your partner to think you're a pervert, or you want to make sure they're really happy so they'll want to have sex with you again, or whatever your attachment is, that leads to repetitive, do what worked last time, boring sex. Because if you got this attachment to outcome, you're just going to keep trying to do whatever you think worked before, and you're never going to venture from that formula, and now you're going to have this really boring, boring, boring sex. Three rules. Rule number one, and like I said, I usually am presenting this to men, so I'm going to present it as I'm talking to men, and you women, yeah, you can apply this too. Rule number one, approach her as if she is the most adventurous, open-minded woman on the planet. We're just going to assume that she is the most open-minded, adventurous woman on the planet. Because if you assume anything less than that, you're going to put a lid on the possibilities of your sexual relationship.
Right,
if you preempt, if you think, oh, she would never want to do that, or, oh, if I bring this up, or, oh, if I try that, she's going to think I'm some kind of pervert, and so you'd never do it. Well, there's never a chance for anything out of the ordinary or interesting to happen. So we are going to approach her as if she's the most open-minded, adventurous woman on the planet. That's rule number one. I tell that to the guys.
I love it. That's great.
Okay. That's number one. I say, guys, that's your job. Rule number two, it's her job to tell you no if there's anything she does not want to do. You don't have to presuppose a no. It's her job. She's an adult. If she doesn't want X, Y, or Z, or if she's not in the mood, or if that doesn't turn her on right now, it's her job to say, no, I don't want to do that. No, that doesn't appeal to me. No, that doesn't feel good. We don't have to do that for her. Because as soon as we do, we put the lid on a really great sexual opportunity. So, number one, I tell the guy, it's your job to approach her as if she's the most open-minded, adventurous woman on the planet. Number two, it's her job to tell you no if there's something she doesn't want to do. And no does mean no, but no doesn't always mean no tomorrow or no the next week, unless she says to you, never ever do that again. That's a pretty clear no. All right? Rule number three, never take anything personally. Your job is to never take anything personally. So you've approached her as if she's the most open-minded, adventurous woman on the planet. You did X, Y, and Z. You initiated this. You suggested that. She said, no, that doesn't work for me. Don't pout. Don't withdraw. Don't think, oh, no, I did something bad. Just go back to step number one again. Don't take it personally. And I tell you what, this is not only a formula for great, fantastic, you know, hang from the ceilings, go beyond anything you ever imagined kind of sex, it's also a pretty good formula for life. Approach the world as if it's an abundant, prosperous place, a great place for you to get your needs met. Rule number two, the world's going to tell you no sometime. Rule number three, don't take it personally. Go back to rule number one. Talk about opening some doors that you didn't even know were out there. This creates a fantastic relationship, fantastic sex, and a fantastic way of life.
That is excellent. I love it. Thank you for that.
As a single guy, I've occasionally shared that formula with women that I was dating before we actually began, you know, being sexual. And it is amazing just the look in their eyes they get when I tell them that formula.
It makes a heck of a lot of sense. It's profound. It's simple. It's wise. Yeah, that's a keeper. And we have a question from Richard in Nantucket, submitted online.
Oh, man, that just sounds like a bad lyric waiting to happen, doesn't it?
When a married couple has not had sex in a long time, or it's infrequent, how do they jumpstart their sex life again? What do you think?
I typically tell the man, start telling the truth. Because here's the thing. As I said, I've been working with couples for 25 years, and the number one thing I hear from women, and especially from women who are in relationships with a nice guy, the number one thing is, I just don't trust him. Say he's going to do something, but doesn't follow through. You know, he'll say this, but then he changes his mind. He'll out and out lie to me, or he won't tell me the whole truth. And the one thing that I've found, and I've been saying this for a while, and I always expect the feminist gods to strike me down when I say it, but it hasn't happened yet. In fact, when I say it to women, they nod their head. And I tell people, the one thing I know for sure about the feminine is that women are primarily security-seeking creatures. They want to feel safe. In fact, I went to a class just two nights ago on a woman teaching it called 72 Ways to Flirt. And one of the first things she said is, men, when you approach women, understand that there's safety issues involved. And I thought, amen, that's what I've been saying. Women want to feel safe. They want to feel secure. Now, when a man doesn't tell his woman the whole truth, when he says he's going to do something and doesn't follow through, when he acts out of integrity, totally disrupts that sense of security that she has. And the thing that I've found consistently over and over again, that if a woman doesn't trust her man, she doesn't want to have sex with him. And it's not that she's punishing him or consciously doing this, she just does not feel physical sexual attraction towards a man who doesn't make her feel safe or secure. And so the thing that I tell men, if you want to jumpstart the sexual relationship with your partner, you have to become a man of integrity. And it is amazing how many men I've told this to, and they go home from a group or a seminar, and they go home, they don't do this to get sex, but for, you know, totally unrelated. They go home and they say, you know what, I haven't been acting with integrity. Here's something that I haven't told you about that you really need to know. Or they go home and they say, you know what, I haven't been acting with integrity. Here's a boundary that I need to set. I just need to be clear. This is my boundary on this issue. They come back to group a week later, or they email me a week after that, and they'll go, you know what, when I first did this, you know, I expected the ceiling to come off, a roof to come off, and we haven't had sex in months. And I went home and told her the truth about this, or I went home and set a boundary. And at first there was a little bit of tension, but we talked through it. And we've been having the best sex of our lives every night for the last week. Hmm. Now, what changed? The man went home and told the truth. Actually, their fear was the woman might say, you know, that's terrible that you lied to me, I'm leaving you. Well, usually they're upset that they were lied to, but the fact that he did a bold step and told the truth about something that he knew she might be upset about just totally regenerated that sense of trust and security, and now she wants to be close to that man. So that's my number one advice to men for jump-starting a sex life is tell the truth.
Tell the truth and treat her as if she's the most open-minded, adventurous. Oh, that's great. Very good. Dr. Glover, anything to say in closing before we open up the lines to our participants?
You know, what I would say in closing is that, and I say this in the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, and that is the things I'm talking about are not just a few little things to try on for size in your life. It's not just a couple things you're going to tweak. And I found this out because I'm a recovering nice guy. And when people work with me, they really express how much they appreciate the fact that I'm doing this exact same work in my life. I'm not just some therapist that thought up some theory and wrote a book about it. This was is No More Mr. Nice Guy's autobiographical. And truth is, this isn't just, as I said, a couple things we're just going to try differently. This is about turning our view of ourselves and the view of our view of the world totally inside out. And that's challenging. And it's not going to be easy. And there is no easy way to do this. It's going to mean facing fears. It's going to mean learning to soothe your anxiety. It may mean risking relationships getting blown apart because you start setting boundaries or standing up for yourself or telling the truth. It's going to mean major life upheaval and change. And so the one thing I encourage people consistently, get a support system to help you do this. Whether this is a therapy group, whether it's a 12-step group, whether it's a minister, a rabbi, a good friend. Usually your spouse is not a good person to get as this person because they have an investment. Even if they love you, they have an investment in you not changing because that'll create anxiety for them. So have somebody who can accept you, who can promote this change, whether, as I said, whether that's a group. I have an online support group on my website, nomoremrniceguy.com, and it's free, and there's several different forums on there where people can go and get support for making these changes in their lives. So don't try to do it on your own. Nice guys try to do everything by themselves. Get help and be ready to lean into the things that make you anxious and be prepared for a whole different world to open up in front of you.
Excellent. Good stuff. We have a question submitted by Anna, who has a client who's being bullied by one of his customers. There's a lot of money involved. How can the client stand his ground and keep his customer?
That's an attachment to outcome. I hear people say things that a lot. Well, how can I do this, but this still happen? Like, how can I approach a woman, but her not reject me? How can I stand my ground and my customer not leave? I don't know. I just don't know, because that's trying to manage the outcome so we don't have to feel anxious.
Right.
When you set boundaries, you deal with the reality that other people may or may not like your boundary. They may or may not stick around. And integrity is everything. It's all that we've got. And it's its own reward. And I'm a businessman. I've told the truth. I've set boundaries with customers, with clients, knowing I might lose them as a client. And 9 times out of 10, they tell me, thanks for telling me the truth about that. I appreciate that. When the nice guy is thinking, well, if I tell the truth or set a boundary or if I don't let this person treat me badly or take advantage of me, the fear is they'll leave, well, they may leave. And I call that getting to rejection quickly. Find out. Are they just sticking around because you let them walk on you? Set your boundary. Be willing to say goodbye. That's the only way I know to do it.
Right. Chances are it's not a great customer or client if they're a bully, and the only way it works is if you allow yourself to be bullied.
Exactly, and that's true in any kind of relationship, whether it's with a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. If you think you have to tolerate bad behavior just to keep them around, man, that's not the kind of person you want around you.
Right, and they're not going to respect you, you're not respecting yourself, and your business is going to suffer. We have a question from Mark in New York. He asked about same-sex couples. what would be the corollary to the women are security-seeking creatures for men in a same-sex relationship?
You know, that's a good question. And I'm heterosexual, and the majority of the guys I work with are straight guys. But typically, at my seminars, 20 to 30% of the guys are gay. And I often check out with them when I'm talking to them, especially about relationship, man-women kind of stuff. I'll say, how does this translate to your experience as a gay man in gay relationship? And what is amazing is, across the board, gay men tell me, well, this just fits perfectly. You know, it would translate the gender, you know, but it translates perfectly. So even, you know, if you think about it, in any relationship, whether it's man and woman, man-man, woman-woman, trust is key. Trust is fundamental. And if you mess with trust, you mess with a sense of security. So it's not just women that require trust to feel close. We men require it too. And so whether we're talking about men or women, yeah, act with integrity. Be a transparent, what you see is what you get kind of person. And that is what allows people to get close to you, feel safe with you. And if we're talking about the sexual connection, it allows them to feel free to really let go, because in sex, you have to trust to let go. And so you have to build that outside the bedroom so it's there inside the bedroom.
Excellent, excellent answer.
David, when you asked me if I was a nice gal when I first came on, I said, well, sure. Well, I'm really not. Not anymore. So this has really been, it's more of a comment than a question. This has been an absolutely fabulous telephone call. I've learned a great deal. I think what really resonated most with me was a woman's needs are all about safety and security. And I'm early 50s, and I'm not sure I ever really thought about what my actual needs were. I've always sort of taken care of that.
I found that to be true because, and I've worked with women so much that if they're not feeling safe and secure in relationship, whether that was with their mother, their boyfriend, husband, what they have to do is they have to take that into their own hands. And so what's happened with a lot of women in our culture is they've had to become controlling. They've had to try to manage their life to keep it under control, to feel safe. And most women I talk to don't like that feeling of having to be controlling.
Right.
They would rather feel safe enough to just let go and melt into the situation and into their relationship and know that they can let go of those walls and feel safe.
That is absolutely true, because I've been married 3 times, and each time I guess I've set myself up into a situation to be disappointed again. I've just recreated my childhood drama, and I've always been very good about making myself safe and secure. And every guy I meet now says, well, you just don't really need anybody. It was so spot on to say that my needs are about safety and security, and frankly, you know, if I get into a relationship, I think I can articulate that better now. This is what my needs are. Be all this strong person, which I really don't like being all that way all the time, that great in business, but that really sucks in relationships.
Well, you know what's interesting? I'm 51, and about two years ago, I started taking salsa lessons. I thought it looked like a great dance, it was a way to be social, and it was a way for me to overcome some beliefs that I couldn't dance. And so I started taking salsa lessons, and it was one of the most powerful experiences I've had, because it's taught me as a man the power of leading, to lead clearly and firmly. And one of the best compliments I get from women on the dance floor is, oh, you're a firm lead. And they like that, they feel secure when I lead clearly and firmly. But it's interesting, in classes that I take, a lot of times we'll be learning something and I'll be leading, and the woman will resist it, or the woman will try to back lead or pre-lead or anticipate. And I'll smile and I'll gently say, let me lead. And a lot of times the women, kind of, they shake their hands or their arms, they go, I know, I have a hard time letting go of control. And they smile because they know. They've learned, oh, I got to control everything in my life to feel safe. And now here's a man on the dance floor, lovingly and gently leading them, and it's a challenge for them to let go of that. But you know what? I've been in classes where the instructor will tell the women, all right, follows, close your eyes, and just let the lead lead you with your eyes closed. And I've seen some women struggle with that. It's difficult. But I've seen other women just get just this look of bliss on their face as their eyes are closed, and they can feel a man leading them securely around the dance floor. And it just it goes to the very core of their feminine, and it just brings out this blissful feeling in them. And that's true not just on the dance floor. That's true in life, and it's true in the bedroom.
Yeah, I have to absolutely agree with you on that. That's definitely right on.
You said something before about how telling anything less than everything, anything less than the truth, leaving anything out, is not being completely honest. And I've been advised in the past when I've been coached by people on how to tell somebody something, that if there's a particular piece of information that isn't particularly helpful to the person when I share with them my story, whatever it is I need to come clean about, that is only going to cause more harm, and that knowing that information that isn't going to enable that person to really do anything differently, then it might be best to leave it out if it's only likely to bring harm to the situation. Like,
right,
I should have told you this sooner, but I didn't, you know, or something like that. What do you say to that?
If you should have told them sooner, you should still tell them. But you're right. Here's the thing that I would encourage you to pay attention to. Are you leaving something out because it makes you anxious to tell them that and you're afraid they're negatively going to react to the information? Or are you being judicious in leaving the information out because they don't need to know it and it may just cause them harm? There's a big difference there. And sometimes we're not the best judge of that, so you maybe need to sound this out with somebody else first to kind of get some objective feedback, because oftentimes we'll think, well, it'll just hurt them if I tell them, but the truth is, no, we're just afraid they're going to be pissed off at us.
And I might have used the word harm a little too freely. Just, yeah, it might only upset them further but won't help them. So it might not bring harm to them. It might just piss them off, which maybe they don't need.
I assume that everybody I'm working with personally or professionally are adults, and they can handle the truth. And, mm-hmm. and if I tell the truth with love and it causes them upset, my belief is they can get over that. Now, mm-hmm. here's the thing. There's one thing, though, that I've found in our culture, is that people think if somebody, for example, asks you a point-blank question, we tend to think there are two options. One is to tell the whole truth and leave nothing out, and the other option is to lie. Well, there's actually a third option, and that is to have judicious boundaries. Because if somebody asks me a personal question that I don't want to give them that information and it's not relevant to our relationship, you know, I can lovingly say, that's none of your business. And we don't have to tell the whole truth just because somebody asks, right? But if I've done something that is pertinent to the other person and I'm withholding it purely because I don't want them to be upset, that's lying. And nice guys will often say, well, I don't want to tell the whole truth because I don't want to upset anybody. And I usually call them on that one and say, yeah, you don't want people upset. You do have a caring part about you where you don't want people to be hurt or upset. Bottom line is, you're covering your behind. You don't want them upset at you because that makes you anxious.
Attached to the outcome, it's trying to anticipate their response and being attached to it being okay. And that's a slippery slope because if you're doing it, you're doing it. So you're not going to be telling your whole truth.
Exactly. One of the best examples I learned from this professionally is that, you know, we have several taboos in our culture about things you just don't talk about. And one of them is weight, especially for women. And in the past, I've had clients come into my office. A female client is obviously overweight. And she would talk to me about this, that, and the other thing is why she's seeking therapy. And then about 45 minutes into the session, you know, my anxiety would say, well, don't bring up her weight issue if she doesn't. But I realized that wasn't loving. She was there to deal with the whole truth. And so typically I would say then after 45 minutes, I go, okay, how about your weight issues? And I would just see a sigh of relief come over them. And then they could start talking about it freely because I was willing to speak the truth, bring something out that culturally we say, oh, don't bring those things up. And my codependents mm-hmm. might get in the way to not bring it up. But that wouldn't make me a good therapist. And so I've learned, with love, just go to the truth.
Excellent. Good stuff. And it's time for us to close. Dr. Glover, before we close, I just got to share with you, I've received a slew of compliments and thank yous. Mark from San Jose says, great call, very useful. My issue is that I've been conditioned so long to care for others' needs. I have a heck of a time figuring out what I want. And he goes on and on. It's just... this really has impacted him. This is a great call for him. Debbie in Seattle says, this was an eye-opener. Ms. Nice Gal is running like crazy through my family right now. My sister, myself, my niece, I can see my role in the family changing by being in integrity and speaking the truth with love. Thank you. Joan from Australia says, thank you, Dr. Glover and David. I really enjoyed and learned from the seminar. I've been telling the truth for some time now, and it's definitely very freeing. There's more coming in. So, I think suffice it to say, this has been an outstanding seminar. You've been a hit. It's a great topic, and you've delivered it wonderfully. Thank you very much, Dr. Glover. Thank you for joining us. For more information about Conscious Relationship Network, go to consciousresponsibilityresources.com.
Well, thank you all for being part of this. It was great. I had a great time.
It was really wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Glover. Okay, thanks for coming, everybody. See you next month.